TV and radio broadcaster Amanda Keller came tearing out of high school as an unspeakably talented teenager, ready to throw her hat into the air and shout, "New York, I'll give you one last chance." Except she was in Beecroft. But that didn't stop her, of course. Amanda Keller had everything. Charm, wit, a strong work ethic, and a passion for Barry Manilow that defies good taste and common sense. Amanda Keller has written a memoir that contains answers to the most important secrets in the universe, like how to get lost in Guatemala in the middle of the night, how to avoid cooking dinner, and how to drop a boy that you never really went out with in the first place. I recorded this conversation with Amanda in Brisbane, where she spent her earliest years. Now, it was a brutally realistic discussion of painfully embarrassing moments, including things like car sickness and natural bodily functions, so consider yourself warned. Her memoir is called Natural Born Keller, and this conversation was recorded at the Brisbane Powerhouse with a live audience. Mandy, there was so much vomiting in your early childhood years. What brought that on?
Well, a lot of it was car sickness. I remember anywhere we'd go, and we, in those days, we had relatives that lived, we still do, all over Australia, and on our holidays we'd be packed into the car and we'd drive from Brisbane to Adelaide or Sydney to Mooloolambar or anywhere that involved a long, boring trip. We seemed to be doing that on our holidays. And I'd have an empty ice cream container on my lap that would be filled to the plimsoll line before too long. I'm surprised my brother can still eat ice cream. It was a very unattractive image. And Mum would just be patting me on the head towards the end, saying, "One more mile, one more mile," as we're driving to Kalgoorlie or something. So there was a bit of vomiting there.
Tell me about the day you brought wedding cake to school with you.
Big excitement. My aunt had got married, and there was a world of difference in the life from my mum to my auntie. Mum was the eldest of the family, and she had to leave school at 16, and she joined the bank, and then when she married my dad, she had to leave the bank. And yet in the 10 years between her life and her sister's life, who was 10 years younger, so many things had changed for women. My auntie travelled across Afghanistan in a combi van. She got married overseas. She got three different degrees. Life had changed a lot. And so it was so exciting for our family when a small piece of wedding cake arrived from Auntie Julie overseas. And I remember taking a piece of it to school. I would have been in earliest primary school. And I had it in this beautiful little tin, like a tiny bird. And I ate it at recess and then did a giant spew. And as I caught the hot lava in my hands, I remember standing out the front of the teacher congratulating me that I'd caught it in my hands. And I felt a mixture of shame and pride that I felt many times when I've been sick since. There's always an upside, isn't there?
There's always an upside, that's right. You're a glass half full with vomit girl rather than a glass half empty of vomit sort of girl.
That's a good way to look at it, I think.
It is. You found some old teenage diaries. There's this lovely entry from when you were 15, Amanda, where you say, "I wonder why I was born. There must be a purpose for me. Otherwise, why was I born out of everyone and everything? I might have been born a microbe or an insect." Isn't that freaky?
You know, I don't think I've had a deep thought in my head ever since. That's why the diary was so interesting to me, because I thought I was a regular teenager, and maybe all teenagers are like this, but when I found the diary, I realised that what a turgid pain in the neck I was, that every emotion was so, so heightened, and whether it was something very important that had happened or something completely trivial, it was all felt at this enormous level. And I just wrote about it ad nauseum in the diary.
Yeah, but I also get this kind of burning sense of wonder as well. That's a really lovely thing to think, like, why, how am I here? How has this happened? Why is there something instead of nothing? Why me and not a microbe and not something
else? Yes, I don't think I think that anymore, which in a way is a shame. And with my children now who are 14 and 12, when we talk about belief systems and what do I believe and do I believe in God and do I believe in the afterlife, I still don't know what I think. I think I must have stopped thinking at 15.
How did you deal with the kind of normal kind of friction that tends to pop up between mother and daughter during those critical teenage years?
It's funny. I sometimes felt that Mum didn't always see me And, for example, when I went to uni and I wanted to dress like the girl from the Thompson Twins, or I wanted to buy clothes in the army disposal stores, Mum made me a series of jumpers that had pastoral scenes on them. And she had done the Knitwick course, which was a sewing course that you did for stretchy material. And she'd made the whole family matching tracksuits that collected lint every time we left the house. So I sometimes felt that she didn't know who I wanted to be. And yet, Mum passed away 10 years ago, and I get it now. I get that love is a doing word, and that those stitches, every stitch had love in it. And now when I wash my son's clothes and I put them in the drawer and I say, look, I've done your washing because I've done all those actions with love, they look at me and go, of course you did, you're my mother. So I'm glad that I got a chance to say those things to Mum before she passed away, that I get now that was love at work, even though I was an ungrateful child at the time.
You see, when you were a teenager, you were looking for a sensitive guy, and God bless you for that. I mean, really, because, you know, when I was in high school, I always thought girls were only ever interested in the big, buffy footy players, the, oh, Daryl, I know he's a dickhead, but I love him, you know, that kind of phenomenon. So God bless you for that, Amanda, for being on the hunt for sensitive guys. When you say that, though, did you mean it?
I think I did mean it. And I thought, in my diary, if I had a drink every time I said the word sensitive, I would be Oliver Reed. I was determined that anyone who was sensitive, and I don't even really know what I meant by sensitive. I think I meant someone who, you know, that's why I like Barry Manilow, because he wrote beautiful songs and he wasn't particularly attractive, which seemed to go hand in hand with sensitive. So I think that's what I thought that meant. I just said something terrible to you, Richard.
Yeah, you have, yeah. In your search for sensitive guys, you were often seeing them all over the place. I'd love you to read this entry here from your diary.
Do I have to? Because this one's bum-clenchingly excruciating. Don't judge me, all right?
I should just preface this by saying this is after you've seen Jesus Christ Superstar, where the actor playing Judas in it was African-American. I'll just preface it with that comment.
You've phrased it much more nicely than I have. Thank you. I've just watched the American movie Jesus Christ Superstar. Whenever I watch something like that, I get all choked up and speechless because of the sheer emotion that comes from it. Carl Anderson was just fantastic as Judas. Here we go. Mum tells me not to marry a Negro, but if I want to, I will. To me, they always seem so much more sensitive. They have the most beautiful hands. In fact, I'd rather marry a Negro. You know, I toyed with whether to put that in, but I had to stay true to the awfulness of the diary. And I'm sure Mum didn't phrase it exactly like that, but maybe she did.
Were there rules about who you couldn't marry from your
mum
at that
age?
Well,
actually, when my auntie, the younger one who I was telling you about, went overseas, these were the times. My grandfather said, don't marry a black or a Catholic. How good's that? I think she might have done both, if I remember correctly.
Do Catholics also have lovely hands?
I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do.
You write in your memoir that you can see the diary was a way of making sense of the death of your friend, Alana. How old was she when she died?
We were both, I think we were 15. And it's only when I found the diary under the house in my adult years, I saw the whole context of it. I'd started the diary when Alana had died from leukemia when we were at school. And so the first few entries are about processing that, about the dreams I'd have that she'd come back and I'd say, where were you? And she said, oh, I died, but I'm back now. She had done a maths exam not long before she passed away. And when the results came back, she hadn't done well, funnily enough. I took them because I didn't want her parents to see she hadn't done well in a maths exam, like they'd have cared. But I feel sorry for me too at that period, because at one stage she leaned over and she told me that she'd come out of remission. And I was so not wanting to hear it, not knowing how to deal with it. I pretended I hadn't heard what she'd said. And I tortured myself for such a long time after that. And now as a mother of a 14-year-old, I just think, oh, you know, I wasn't much older than I was 15. Think, oh, you poor bugger. And I had lunch with Alana's mother last year. And her brother, who I'd also gone to school with, said, Mum would like to have lunch with. And I hadn't seen her since those early days. And she said, as I walked down the street, she was straight back there. And imagine the sliding doors of that. She'd lost her at 15, 16. And here's me at 53 just the sliding doors of fate, of the touchstone of the age Alana would have been. It must have been very hard. She was charming and lovely, and she's had a wonderful life of travel has gone on to have a wonderful life, but, you know, she would never obviously have got over that. And now as a grown-up, I see all that so differently.
Why were you feeling guilty about her death?
I felt guilty that I hadn't talked to her about it, but I just didn't have the equipment. I didn't have the words to say. I didn't know how to talk to her. And I sat in the room, this is the room where she passed away, I sat in the room and she had one of those old digital clocks, that those old ones where the numbers would flip over, and the noise of it was, click, click. And just to sit there passing the time at the tail end of her illness like that, it haunted me. But I remember sitting there and not talking about anything that mattered. I don't think I could have said any of the words.
It's probably enough that you sat with her. It's a thing I think you forget when you become an adult, and it's so important not to forget it as a parent, is the kids blame themselves for everything that goes wrong. It's a really common thing. I don't know, are you conscious of that with your own kids, to remind them that if something's gone wrong, it's not their fault? Because sometimes they'll conclude that and you won't even be aware of it.
But unless they tell you, you don't know.
No, you don't know. No.
That's actually, it's quite interesting. I should go home and say just a generic don't worry to them when I get home. Hey, just don't worry.
Some of the best diary entries are, of course, as you say, about Barry Manilow. Again, I'd love you to read it, please.
I can't help thinking that now in New York, Barry's hometown, it'll be 10 o'clock tomorrow and it's freezing cold. I imagine me and him snuggled together in floppy warm jumpers in front of a fire with hot chocolate. I think the drink, not the band, I think. Wow, what bliss. Oh, bum, I wish this would happen to me. It was all so innocent. There was nothing saucy about it.
I know. It's the thing. It's not a sexual fantasy. It's a companionship fantasy.
Yeah, it is. You know, it was a companionship fantasy. And I think it was that thing of wanting... He'd meant so much to me, is wanting to meet him and have him know me. I think maybe that was it. But it was about warm jumpers and hot chocolate.
And that's where it would stop, in your mind?
I never got any further than that, which shows you the naivety. And I was in my mid-teens. That's probably 15, 16 years old. I don't know if you'd find such a gormless teen anymore.
Tell me how you met your first boyfriend, Morris.
Carol, who lived next door to me, we were probably 15, 16. Everything seemed to happen then. And we went to Parramatta Shops, and these two guys came up to us and said, do you want to go with us? And I was terrified, but we both said yes. And then then we swapped phone numbers and they walked off and that was it. No further words were spoken, but we were going with them. I can't remember Carol's one's name, but mine was Morris, and I cut out his name and put it in a locket around my neck. And he'd phone a few times, but I don't think people can appreciate how hard dating rituals were in these days. There was one phone in the house, sat on a phone table with a phone chair next to it in a corridor where the whole family could hear. So he'd phone up very occasionally and I'd just go, yeah, okay, bye. And that was it. And then it was decided that we had to drop them. So Carol phoned Morris and said, can you tell what's his name? He's dropped. And now Amanda's got something to tell you. So I said to him, and I remember this, I said, you're the best boyfriend I've ever had, but I've got to drop you. I'd never seen him again from that day when he said, do you want to go around? They were heady days.
Embarrassment is a painful thing and it's important to avoid it at all costs. How important was that for you in your teen years, Amanda?
I don't know if all teenagers were like this, but with all the girls at school, to be embarrassed was a fate worse than death. If you could bite down on a cyanide capsule to avoid embarrassment, you would. But the girl at school that you all wanted to be had a bit of a lisp, and she used to say, humbathing. So we all said, humbathing. And anything that could happen could be so embarrassing. There was one day I was walking home across the oval, and a guy on the other side of the oval kicked a ball, and as soon as it left his foot, I knew it was going to hit me in the head. I just knew it. But I kept walking and I went way up into the air. I didn't even bother averting my path because there was no point. So I just kept walking and sure enough, it just bonked me right on the top of the head. I lost several vertebrae, but I just kept walking because it was too embarrassing to look like I'd felt it. My father says, once we were on holidays at the Gold Coast and I fell down a whole rocky outcrop. I fell down an entire hill and Dad said, it was so strange you smiled all the way down. And it's because I wanted to say, I'm not embarrassed. Nothing to see here. Nothing embarrassing at all.
Say what you like about it, but she kept her dignity.
That's right.
At full cost.
Girls who were in the year older than us said, how degrading. We said, how embarrassing. And they said, how degrading. They were so much more mature than us.
Tell me how your poor friend Vanessa was completely embarrassed at Luna Park.
Well, she had tried to talk her brother, her older brother, and all his friends into taking her to Luna Park. And finally, out of exasperation, her brother gave in. And so she was wearing a top that most of us of that era had made in sewing, which was a thing that crossed in the front that you'd knot in the front. And she thought for good measure she'd put some socks in. But she didn't bet on the power of the rotor, which is this giant drum. That's another spew story, I'm sure, that would just spin around and the floor would drop away. But Vanessa had the ignominy of being on the rotor with her arms pinned behind her head. And she thought, what's that? I can see my peripheral vision. As this sock just snaked up beside her. And there was nothing she could do. That's the stuff that makes you stronger, doesn't it?
That's right.
I'm bad thing.
She went home and never went outside ever again.
No, that's right. She became a nun.
So you went to Mitchell College in Bathurst to do a communications degree. Did you have any kind of career in mind at that point?
Not really. I pictured that tertiary education would be like the girl in the Flake commercial where she had this cheesecloth dress on and she was riding a bicycle eating chocolate and that she'd meet people, she being me, would meet people that looked like the guys from Brideshead Revisited. That's what I pictured it would be like. Instead of that, within the first week of going to Mitchell College, which is now Charles Sturt Uni, I had joined the Claret Club, where instead of just men lounging in cricket whites, there were just fountains of red spew everywhere, that it was just pure vinegar, where people would just drink box after box of vinegar. And so it wasn't quite the cultured beginnings I thought it would be. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I took communications because a friend of mine was doing it and I thought it's an arts degree with a bit of something else so that sounds like I'm trying to achieve something. But I never really knew.
That's where you met the young Andrew Denton for the first time. Mm. Paint me a picture of young Andrew in those halcyon days.
The first time I met Andrew, he called me a fishwife. And the history of our friendship is that we've tried to offend each other ever since. But it's funny now when I meet people, women, who just, you know, think, oh, Andrew's so gorgeous. Because at uni, everyone said, oh, look, let's just keep it as friends. He was one of those sensitive guys. But he was dark and funny even then. In those days, he was known as Kit Denton's son. Kit being a famous writer, and then a few years later, Kit was, Andrew's father, and all the tables had turned a bit.
How did he prey on your trusting nature? How did he despoil your trusting nature?
These stories make me sound like an imbecile, but Andrew is very persuasive, and I don't know why I fell for it, but he used to play tricks even on his own sister when he was a kid. She was, this is just to give you a history of how he can just detonate a little lob in a prank somewhere. His sister was working on an enormous jigsaw puzzle. And I think it might have been something with a Loch Ness monster or something or other. And she went out one afternoon, he finished the puzzle, drew in a submarine with a periscope, I think, and then took it apart again to the point where she was, but drew the same thing on the box. So that weeks later, she finishes it, sees this weird thing in the middle of it, picks up the box and it's on that as well. It's the sort of thing he would do. But what he did with me, and it sounds ridiculous, but he must have been very convincing. He told me that the writers of Mr. Ed had been very subversive and it had been a very well-known industry secret that that whenever Mr. Ed was speaking, there was a hidden reference to talking genitals. And I don't know why, but I believe that. And it was years later when Andrew was with me when I was telling someone that story and he looked aghast at me. This fell about laughing. He couldn't believe I'd fallen for it. And on another occasion, we were working on radio together and we did a charity car day and we were awarded a giant novelty check and he told me it was legal tender. And I believed him. And it was in the back of my car for a week or so. I was scared it was going to snap. And it was only my laziness that stopped me taking it into a bank. How embarrassing would that have been?
Your first job on TV was on Simon Townsend's Wonder World. Mm. Simon Townsend's Wonder World, hosted by Simon himself, sitting next to a gigantic, panting bloodhound, as I recall. Mm. What was your role on that show?
I was a researcher. I think that that's the hardest job I've ever had. And many people I've worked with through the years have all said the same thing. It created a great work ethic, but it was really hard. My job was to line up two stories every day. Even if there was a typhoon and there was a power blackout, I had to find some kind of story for the crew to do. It took me years after that to wake up and hear the rain on the roof and not panic. It was really, it was hard. They were great years. And I learnt so much.
I don't think you ever quite get out of the habit of over-preparing after that, do you? You always feel a little knot of anxiety about getting everything done before you go and do the thing.
I'm still like that. And I don't know whether that's because of those days or that's just my nature. But yes, I'm the girl who does the homework. I over-prepare.
How did you get the job at Beyond 2000? You had that first on-camera proper reporter role there.
Yes, I had done some stories. Ray had said to me, I think you should do some stuff in front of the camera. And on the midday show, I'd covered some really meaty stories that I'm surprised Four Corners hadn't tried to get. It was a woman who dressed up her cats as Liberace and Boy George was one of them. Actually, it was hilarious. You could see that cat just wanted to kill it. It was just biding its time. As she'd put this hat on, that would pull its face back and then put plaits on its head. It was just looking at it, like, I'm going to get you. And another story was about a man who had an octopus as a pet. So, obviously, I was going hard on the story.
So you look at that and you think, science reporter, don't you?
Wouldn't you think I should be on Beyond 2000?
Yes.
So I was asked to audition, but I had to come up with my own story for the audition. And my cousin was working with a professor who had a single-person submersible, just a very small little submarine. And he was crouching down behind me as we were slopping around in the water. And I was supposed to open the hatch and say something like, well, it's because of craft such as these that we can patrol the waterways and blah, blah, blah. So instead, I was feeling very queasy by this stage and I opened up the hatch and just did a giant spew. And even worse, that professor was crouching down behind me. And I felt so ill that I also passed some wind in his face. I don't know what story he tells, but it was shocking all around. And then Channel 7 said that they didn't really like my hair and my clothes, and I still got the job. What do you have to do? Was it Ivan Milat, the other person going for that job? Honestly, who didn't get it?
Again, hard work on this show, very, very hard work. What was your work regime like in Beyond 2000?
So hard. We'd go away for maybe 8 weeks at a time and we'd do 22 stories. We would do 22 stories and all of them were locked in before we left. And this is in the days before the internet. This was a show about science and technology. And when I first landed in that office, we didn't even have a fax machine. There were telexes that would snake across the floor. There was no email, there was no internet. So to research a story, you had to stay up till 2 in the morning and phone Mexico, and they'd say, oh, the professor's out for another hour, and you'd just feel like going into a rage. It was a very different world. We'd say, well, can you pop your research in the mail? It was just so different. But we'd go away for 8 weeks, and we'd do a story one day, we'd film the half of the next day, and then travel that night with 25 bags and losing luggage and no sat-nav in the van. These were the days before sat-nav. How we ever found our way anywhere, I don't know. For 6 years, we were always going the wrong direction and always late. We're interviewing, it may have even been the head of Takeshita or something like that. And in those days, there weren't many women travelling in executive roles in Japan. So the crew would often be spoken to as if they were the authority figures. And so you had to try and assert yourself a little bit. But so we're having this meeting and I thought, look, excuse me, I just have to go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom. Many of us are now more familiar with Japanese toilets, but in those days I'd never seen anything like it. It was like Ramsay's throne with these giant panels down the side. I thought, what's this? And these strange illustrations of body parts and whistling music and little spurts of water. I had no idea what any of it was. And so went to the loo and I was trying to find a flush. There's no such simple thing as a flush. I still see it. I bent over the loo, pressed a button, and this metal spike came out. and just turned its evil eye to me and just sprayed me with water. I must have pressed the bidet function. But here's me trying to get respect from these men, and I went back drenched from my head to my shoulders and just pretended nothing had happened. Humbuffing. Nothing to see here.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Today you're hearing a conversation I've recorded with Amanda Keller, TV and radio broadcaster. She's written a memoir. It's called Natural Born Keller. And we recorded this conversation in Brisbane at the Brisbane Powerhouse in front of a live audience. You met your husband, Harley, while working on Beyond 2000. He was a film editor. Was that a love at first sight thing or a bit more of a slow burn?
It was a slow burn. I remember my auntie saying, you know, if two people were on a desert island, you'd probably end up falling in love with each other. And I think that there's an element to choosing to fall in love. Harley and I had worked alongside each other for 2 years. We were colleagues at work. I'd sat beside him while he was editing some of the worst stories I've had to do. And so we sort of had moments of great friendship like that. How romantic. But it took a while before we decided we'll go and see a movie together. And Harley had always had a very dry and droll sense of humour. But then I saw a softness to him, sensitive side.
Sensitive side.
And that was the perfect combination. And almost instantly, we decided to get married. It was 25 years ago. When we went back and told everyone in the office that we were going to get married, people looked at us. It's like saying in your workplace, that person are going to get married. You didn't even know that they knew each other or liked each other. It just happened so quickly.
Is there something in having companionship and friendship that then blossoms into love, as opposed to that thing, you know, you see each other across a crowded room, there's that powerful thing and it overrides everything else, and then you have to learn to be companions and learn to love each other in a different way?
Yes, and in the early days we did have all that. I mean, we still love each other, but in the early days there was that absolute sweaty palms, heart bursting, all those feelings were there. But it seemed that they erupted after a 2-year friendship. And by then I felt that all the homework had been done. I knew him. I knew who he was. I knew the type of person he was. And as I said earlier, I think part of it is timing, is that I was ready for a proper grown-up relationship, and it just seemed that the timing was right. So the universe picked it as well, I think.
How romantic was your wedding?
It was pretty romantic. We got married during the day, and I was dressed as a big blancmange. But actually, it's funny, before the wedding, because I'm not a big frock kind of person, and I thought, I'm going to have to buy some underwear to go under this wedding dress, and I'm not a saucy underwear person. And I went into a shop, and the woman would pull some out, and I remember her saying to me, oh, that's a bit ambitious, isn't it? And she'd pop it back again into the shelf. Oh, thank you. So I had my wedding cotton tails on. But it was a pretty romantic day, I think. Except that night, Harley's friends asked him if he wanted to go and watch the Grand Prix with them, and he said no, so I knew I was well and truly
He was the one.
He's right. The one.
That he didn't peel off to watch the Grand Prix with his mates
He's
on your wedding
one.
Night.
That's right.
That's very sensitive of him, I think. It's fair
I
to say.
I think so too.
Andrew Denton offered you a gig on his new Channel 7 TV show. That was around about 1994, I think, thereabouts, 95. Were you daunted by that, going from reporting to doing comedy?
Oh, so daunted. And just when I thought I had a handle on how to work and what I could do, it's like I started all over again. I was hugely conflicted because I thought, how do I give them permission to laugh with me or at me? I felt like, as I said, I was starting all over again. And the Beyond 2000 office was funny. It was a very funny, caustic, hilarious place. A comedy office isn't always like that. And so I really didn't know where to put myself. And Andrew had faith in me to be funny, but I didn't actually have that faith in myself. Andrew had said, look, I've known you for all these years. You've shown you can do the serious stuff. Let's try and do something, show the other side to your personality. And it took me a long time to be comfortable with being funny. And part of it was that I always thought that being funny meant being a stand-up comedian, I think. And so even now, if I'm described as a comedian, I don't feel that's describing me, because I never did those hard yards of having to do that. So on Andrew's show, we would look at products from around the world, and that seemed to me to be an easier way. We'd find something funny and stupid and make comments about it.
Out of all your products, do you have a favourite from that time?
Safety Man was pretty cool.
What was Safety Man?
Safety Man is a mannequin He had a plastic moulded head, but very handsome. But he had his giant built torso and some strap-on legs that were like draft exclusive, like Aussie Ostrich, but a really spunky version. And he was designed for women in America so they wouldn't get carjacked. So you'd prop him in the car next to you so they'd think you had some beefy guy. And he came in what looked like a cricket bag. And you could get one that was salt and pepper, so he was dark with a bit of, you know, grey flecks. Or you could get a black one. And it wasn't because of Mum that I didn't go for that one. I want you to know that. The only one we could get was the salt and pepper.
What happened to Safety Man?
Well, we had him in the house for many years, and he'd freak out a lot of people. We dressed him in a tux and had him in the lounge room. And in the end, a man contacted me. He also had a safety man. And he said his safety man was going on a trip around Australia and they were wondering if my safety man could go. So like two grey nomads. Off they went. We got letters occasionally, but I haven't heard from him for some time.
That really happened?
That really happened.
He wanted your safety man as a genuine companion to his safety man?
I didn't think to question his motives, Richard. He said he thought his safety man would enjoy the company, and so off he went. I didn't want to deny safety man his own life.
I'm about to go on a caravan tour around Australia with a mannequin. What's the one thing I need?
Another mannequin.
No back chat from him, is
no,
there?
No, that's quite
no
right.
Back chat. You and Andrew went on to Triple M in Sydney to do a breakfast program from some years. It was a very, very popular breakfast program. And you write that at the same time, Amanda, you were going through IVF. And as I read that, I really felt for you. Did you tell anyone at work you were going through it at the time?
I told Andrew. It's funny that when I look back on it, I just got on with it. And I think going to work every day saved me. But when I hear other people are going for it, I really feel for them. And a friend of mine who read the book said, I've never told anyone but my child's IVF too. And she said, I cried for myself when I read what I'd gone through. Sometimes it takes someone else to let you feel it. But I told Andrew, but I had daily injections, and these were the days where I think the way you do it now, the needles are small and you do it yourself. These were needles that were as big as, you know, from your finger to your wrist, these really long needles that Harley had to administer every day. And just the hormones up and down, up and down. But I didn't want to tell a lot of people because I couldn't have stood the, so any news this month? It's so hard. It's hard enough when your friends are having babies. It's hard enough when people say, oh, gee, you've been married 8 years now. Any children? You go, you've got no idea. But you just smile and go, oh, well, you know, no one would ask Harley. They just always ask me. So I didn't tell everyone. But I, to the point where I'd be at work in the morning, I'd have a general anaesthetic and a procedure that afternoon, and I'd come back to work the next day. But I really think in a way it saved me. Those early hours when your alarm goes off at 4 o'clock are the loneliest hours in the world. That minute in particular when the alarm goes off, and if things aren't right with your world, that's the darkest moment. So as soon as you get up, get in the shower and get the day going and it's okay. But if I didn't have somewhere to go every day and something else to think about, I think I would have gone crazy.
And you have month followed by another month followed by another month and there's no result. Do you get to a point where you think, God, everyone in the world is pregnant except for me?
Oh, I remember seeing the film Notting Hill. And spoiler alert, she's pregnant at the end. But I was just outraged. I was so angry. We'd just been told that another attempt hadn't worked. I thought, let's go and see a movie. Friend said, oh, go and see Notting Hill. You'll love it. And in this film, these two people meet, they fall in love, and at the end she's pregnant. So it shouldn't happen like that. It shouldn't happen that easily. What's the assumption that love equals pregnancy? I found it so hard. I remember interviewing Ben Elton at the time. He had a film and a book called Maybe Baby. And I loved the fact that the book ended where you didn't know whether they were going to have a baby or not. And he said that sometimes surviving it is enough. And that's true. And I used to say to our doctor, tell me when to stop because I don't want to be defined by this. I really don't want to spend the next 10 years trying. But how would you know when to stop? How would you know when they keep thinking maybe next time, maybe next time? But also because I was such a, you know, a good student and a girl who does the work, every time I'd go into the clinic, I felt like I was letting everyone down. They were there to get us pregnant and I just couldn't do it. I felt like it was my fault somehow.
Then eventually you got the one little embryo, it just took hold.
In a way, Harley and I swapped roles during that time because he was very guarded beforehand. But the minute we saw that tiny, tiny heartbeat, he just opened the door to it and said, this is it. Whatever happens, this is it. whereas I went the other way, and I was so scared that I wouldn't really be pregnant. I was desperate to have morning sickness because I didn't believe I was pregnant, and I never got morning sickness. But I wanted to have a scan every day if I could. I just needed to have someone tell me that after all those years, and it was years, that little thing had stuck. And actually, there were three in a test tube at the end. And the doctor said, look, we've got a new technique. Why don't we do this new technique? And I said, look, there's three in that tube. I think I owe it to them. And so they were the ones they put in. And it was at the closing ceremony of the Sydney Olympics. And I'm watching giant Cupid dolls and thongs go around the circuit. And I started to get some spotting. And I remember just thinking, oh, please no, please no. Because for the first time ever, my hormone levels were up, my bloods were showing that something was happening. It felt for the first time after all those years it was a possibility. And in the end it was the other ones coming away, and it was Liam, who's now 14, and he would not have passed muster in their grading system, but that little runt of the litter is now 14 but over 6 foot tall, A-grade student, A-grade rugby, just this renaissance man he seems to me. And he all came from that little freezer. Oh, thanks.
Here's the thing about FM radio. Everything is bloody grist for the mill. How involved were your listeners with your pregnancy at the time?
Oh, that was something I will never forget. And I still get goosebumps when I think about it. People tell me that they were in their cars when Andrew said that Liam had been born. And people felt that they were part of the story, and I love that. And when Liam was in my womb, he was called Norbert. And even today, people will say, oh, is this Norbert? People still remember that. And so I love that they were part of his life in that way. And this is, we talk about radio being the tribal drum. It really is, because it's another day on air. It was the day that Liam was born. It's so strong in my memory, funnily enough. But also, I think I'd only just gone back to work from maternity leave. I'd been back at work for one day on September 11. So I remember being up in the middle of the night feeding Liam and seeing the world change. And that next morning on air, Andrew and I often talk about that as being the most extraordinary morning, because people were waking up to hear that news and we had to tell them what had happened. And people were calling in. We were on air for 6 hours and people were calling in tears, and people were speaking of love, and people were speaking of fear, and people were speaking, oh, is this World War III? I've got friends over there, what do I do? And Andrew's kept a lot of the emails we got from that time, and they are a great microcosm of what we were all feeling at that time. And it was an extraordinary day to be on the radio.
Here's the thing, the pregnancy was so nerve-wracking and emotional, and yet when the moment of labour is about to arrive, you were so blithely confident it would be no big thing.
I remember being, how stupid. I was looking forward to labour. And the minute it started, I thought, oh, what a friggin' idiot. And then when the nurse said, I said, can you put a big needle in my back now, please? And she said, how about I just run you a nice warm bath? I said, how about you just put a needle in there? So I remember watching a Kylie Minogue special on the television. I'd lost control of my legs. I don't know what they were like safety man's legs at that point. When we had done the birthing classes, I'd laughed at the funny head shapes on some of the babies, and I got my own back because Liam was a vacuum pool. And he was tiny. He was like, he was underweight. I don't know how, because he's enormous now. But they wrapped him in foil. He looked like a piece of garlic bread with this big knitted hat on his head. And I was too scared to touch the top of it in case that was the shape of his head. And I wasn't far off. And the doctor said to me, look, his legs are a bit bandy. You'll have to just straighten them out. I was thinking, what? It's my job to straighten his legs out? Oh, it just seemed overwhelming. First he's got a weird head, now I've got to do this with his legs. What's happening?
Friend of a friend giving birth, going through the horrible business of labour, had been in contractions labour for about an hour and a half, and then between contractions she actually said, everyone, I've got an announcement to make. I'm awfully sorry to disappoint you, but I'm sorry, I've decided not to go through with this.
I can completely understand that.
I'm going shopping, she said. And she wasn't joking. You have that kind of madness,
don't
you? Oh,
very much so, because as an adult, and that's what going through IVF, it brings you up against something you can't solve. As grown-ups, if something's hard, you go around it or you fix it or you do something. it was very hard to have this obstacle that I couldn't get past. And same with going through labour. You think, oh, you know, why didn't someone tell me? I don't know how anyone could have told me. But I just thought, oh, this can't be right. I was shocked at how brutal it was. I was just shocked.
What do you mean this can't be right?
This can't be right.
This hurts.
Surely not other people. No one's had it as bad as this, surely. And that's after I'd had the drugs. The worst part was afterwards, because I had stitches and things, and we were told to put those... When we grew up, we used to call them cool pops. Our freezer was full of these long ice things.
Yeah.
And they were in the freezer at the hospital and they said, look, stick those in your undies. So I remember spending such a long time going through the freezer thinking, oh, I only like the red ones. There's only got yellow ones. And then I put one in my undies and it split, and that sugary acid was the most painful thing of the entire process.
So if you learn nothing else from this conversation, don't put a cool pop in your undies.
No. It sounds like a title for a country song.
That's right. And today, of course, you've got two beautiful, strong, healthy, lovely boys.
Yes.
Which is wonderful. Fantastic family life. But, you know, the thing about you, Amanda, is you could just never quite let go of Barry Manilow. So at 46, you and your old friend Melanie decided to go to Vegas to see the man perform. How excited were you both at the prospect of going to Vegas and seeing the magic happen in front of you?
Well, it was so emotional because Melanie and I had grown up together. We were the ones who just loved Barry. Her diary was also full of Barry. And we decided at 46, my mum had passed away, and Melanie was much loved by our family. Melanie's mum wasn't well, and we thought, you know what, as a tribute to our 30-year friendship, let's go to Vegas and see Barry. We didn't put a single cent in a slot machine. We did no gambling. We just went to drink nice wine and see Barry Manilow. And as we did our makeup before we went to see him, I looked at her and thought, this is really a story about us. How many times we've stood next to each other in caravan parks, in our bedrooms, in hotel rooms, doing our smash repairs before going out for the day. And here we were going to see Barry. So we went to see his show in Vegas, and it was so satisfying. We laughed, we cried, we sobbed, we did all kinds of things. And then at the end, through some lies that I told through the radio, I found a chance to have an interview with Barry. So I had a tape recorder in my hand, but really, that was just a prop. I couldn't care less about that. So,
what did you want to happen?
Well, you know what I thought would happen? Yeah. I know I wasn't going to marry him. But I thought at some point there'd be a connection and we'd have dinner and we'd clink a glass and it would be that old thing of we just knew each other. That's what I thought would happen.
You'd recognise each other.
That's what I thought.
As sensitive people.
I thought that's what would happen. So afterwards, we're heralded into this room. They didn't want Melanie to come in, but it was like Black Hawk Down. I said, I'm not leaving her behind. And so, like, the gormless 18-year-old on the door, like, he could care less. There's two women older than his mother trying to get in to see Barry Manilow. So when he was looking the other way, we ran in. And suddenly Barry was there. And it was just extraordinary. And so, oh, it's hard to relay this story. My palms are sweating because it's like the devil took over when I went to talk to Barry. I actually felt that I left my body and went up to the lights. Because the first question I say after all this time to Barry Manilow is, we've come from Australia, we've gone to a lot of trouble. What other lengths have your fans gone to apart from giving you herpes? I have no idea why I would say that. I have no idea.
What
I could see Melanie's face. And Barry looked like this look of distaste and disgust on his face. And then in the midst of that, the tape recorder goes click, and it just, I don't know whether it was on and turned off or what had happened, but I just was so appalled at myself. I just kept talking. So he knew I was a lunatic because this recorder wasn't working, but I just kept talking. And anyway, I felt like I'd made some ground at the end, and we had a little bit of a chat. I thought, we're not going to be going to dinner anytime soon. But then, as we had a photo at the end, his manager said, I'll just take a picture. So he stands in the middle, Melanie and I on either side of him. And as the camera clicks, Barry passes some wind. I actually feel very disloyal telling this story, but I have to. And none of us said anything. I've got the photo in the book of the moment of impact. all of us just smiling. And then as we walked out, I said to Melanie, did you hear that? And she said, yes. And I laughed so hard, I thought I was going to wet my pants. Which would have been a great ending to the story. But you know how I choose to see that? That he was so comfortable around us, we may as well have been married. He was my husband after all.
He's 71, he's married his husband, but you could still get in there. You could still, there's still a chance.
You know, we have a lot in common. We both married men.
That's right. He wrote that song for you, Mandy, too.
I know.
You came and you gave without taking, and I sent you away. Oh, Mandy, can you kiss me and stop me from shaking?
Well, I'm glad. Obviously, you're a closet fan of Barry's as well.
Yeah, it's weird how many of his songs I've just internalised. I've just realised that. It's rather embarrassing. So Madame Tussauds sets up a venue in Sydney and there's a public vote on who should go in and you win. Like, you win this poll to be... What happens when they do that? What happens when Madame Tussauds want to make a waxworks model of you?
I didn't know how to respond. I was so... so chuffed and overwhelmed and embarrassed that it was me. I felt unworthy. Of course, what an incredible thing. But the team come out from London, the same team in England, do them all around the world. They don't outsource, they do them. So this team flew from London. And because you have to stand on a plinth with a plumb, is that what it's called? So they can do 3D imaging?
Oh, plumb line, yeah.
Plumb line. Ooh. So you slowly move around and they photograph you and things. And for them to get the right perspective, we had to do it in my garage, which had cockroach poo everywhere and kids' old bikes. And
are you fully clothed in this?
Yes, well, the thing is, you have to wear something relatively tight-fitting, which I've never done in my life. So I had sort of like almost like gym gear on. So I'm standing there looking slightly deranged because I didn't know what you were supposed to do and what position do you assume? What face do you pull? For all of eternity.
I don't know. What do you do? What did you hit on? What did you settle on?
I kind of put a hand on my hip and kind of smiled. And that was it. And then they did stacks of measurements. How they got through customs, I don't know, because they had a bag of eyeballs. Then they actual eyeballs that they put against your own eyes to see what the colour is. They had bags of hair. They had bags of teeth. And then they go back to England and then... you get to see yourself, and it's unusual. I thought it would be like a mannequin with my face on it or a photo. And so when I actually saw it, I actually burst into tears. And I don't know why. I don't know if I was thinking about Mum and thinking how thrilled she would have been, or I don't... But there was a very strange mix of emotions at its familiarity. It was so weird... And if I stand next to, I shouldn't call it her, when I stand next to her and I feel like she's looking at me, it's like, it is like having something of my DNA. It is so unnerving.
You've worked very hard over the years and you deserve all the success you've had on television, on radio. How do you feel about success? And I ask this because Gerald Stone wrote this book about Channel 9 where he talked about a syndrome called presenter's syndrome, where some presenters get to a place where they become convinced inwardly and secretly they don't deserve their success, and it wears away at them and undermines their self-confidence, makes them snippy. And I know you're not like that. Are you comfortable with being a successful person in media, or are you bewildered, or are you angry by it, or what? How do you feel about it now,
Amanda? A bit of all those things. I have what the imposter syndrome that a lot of people seem to have, that feeling that that anyone could do the job you're doing. And that the more you talk about it, the more likely you are to be exposed. But at the same time, as I've got a bit older, I actually can finally acknowledge that I'm good at my job. I still think that any of my friends could do it, particularly talking on the radio. But I do now recognise that there's a craft to it, and I'm comfortable that I know how to do it. But it's taken me a while to get to that point. I felt for a while that I was just running on a ball and how lucky I was that it was all falling into place. Now I feel like I know what I'm doing and I feel like I deserve to be there. Having said that, with success, I think what's given me some longevity is that I've never locked myself in. My sense of self, I'd like to think, and I think is true, isn't necessarily linked to my jobs, because I've worked on shows that I've read in the paper have been axed. Anytime I'm offered something new on television, I think, well, that'll probably be axed in 2 weeks. I'm quite cynical about it. So my sense of self and my sense of worth isn't necessarily tied up with radio ratings or television success. And I think that's maybe what allows me to keep working.
Here's another thing. You probably don't know this, but people say you're lovely to work with.
Do they?
They do. They do. And I say
they
that
must
too.
Be the drinkers.
They are. And I am. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, please thank the amazing Amanda Keller.
Listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.